Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. Happy New Year's Eve, everyone. We'll start our show this week with our favorite heritage story from this past year. Jim Rapp will tell us about pelagic birding along our inlets and beaches this winter. And then we'll finish up with a look back at all the artist interviews we've done. This year, my favorite heritage story was that of an Eastern Shore, Virginia colonial named Thomas Savage. He was remarkable for his youthful ingenuity and the life he forged here over 400 years ago. I've heard the story of Pocahontas many times, but until recently I had not heard about a young man who played an important part in her story before becoming one of the first English settlers on Virginia's eastern shore. Thomas Savage was just 13 when he sailed from England in 1607 for the Jamestown colony with Captain Christopher Newport. Some accounts suggest that Thomas was passed off as the son of King James I. Others represented him as Captain Newport's son. There is actually no record of where Thomas came from or who his parents actually were. In those days, children were often indentured by that early age. Young people without any prospects could go to county fairs to look for work and sign service contracts for a year or longer. Those wanting to emigrate to the New World usually signed up for a 7-year stint to work off their passage. Thomas started out his journey expecting to be a laborer in the new colony. But the captain recognized his intelligence and presumably an amiable and thoughtful personality. Once they arrived at Jamestown, Virginia, Captain Newport joined Captain John Smith on a trade mission with the local native tribes. Thomas Savage was given, along with other gifts, to Chief Powhatan, who reciprocated with a bushel bag of beans and his own young servant, Namantak. Apparently, this type of exchange had become a common practice. The boys were to be taught their host's language so they could serve as interpreters and spies. Imagine the conversation that must have taken place when Captain Newport talked Thomas into this job. Maybe he thought it would be a great adventure. Maybe he hoped it would be easier work than cutting down trees and plowing fields. Thomas turned out to be well suited to the task before him. Powhatan himself developed great affection for Thomas and took a special interest in him. He became quite adept at his new language and before long was in great demand whenever there were negotiations between the colonists and the local tribes. When the famous princess Pocahontas was ransomed by the English in 1613, it was 19-year-old Thomas Savage who served as interpreter to her brothers. Captain John Smith credited him as indispensable in the talks that brought an end to the first Anglo-Powhatan War and allowed the marriage of Pocahontas to John Rolfe. Thomas's life was not without its trials. Some of Powhatan's family did not appreciate this interloper. To avoid growing danger, Thomas left the tribe to return to Jamestown. Unfortunately, once there, he was never really seen as fully English or fully trustworthy. But his skill as an interpreter kept him busy nonetheless. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and this is the story of Thomas Savage, who was probably the first permanent English settler here on Delmarva. Before long, Thomas was sent on trade missions throughout the region. One such trip brought him to what is now the eastern shore of Virginia. Life for the native people here on Delmarva, particularly down on its southernmost tip, was considerably better than that of their counterparts across the Chesapeake and Jamestown. Farming was easier here, and there was more than enough small game and fishing, even when there was a harsh winter or dry growing season. Surplus food stores were traded to the Jamestown settlers for metal tools and trinkets. Thomas facilitated several exchanges with Deb Divan, the Emperor of the Eastern Shore, who was also known as the Laughing King of the Accomacs and the Nassawadocks. Trade was very profitable for Deb Divan. And he, like Powhatan, became good friends with Thomas Savage as a result. The Laughing King's affection was so great that he gave Thomas a large tract of land in Northampton County, which is still known as Savage's Neck. Deb Divan had a reputation for being easygoing and for valuing his relationship with the English colonists. In 1622, relationships across the bay, however, were not so good. Powhatan's successor, Opechancanough, was plotting an attack on Jamestown. He sent word to Deb Devon that he wanted him to send certain poisonous plants that grew here on the eastern shore to use against the settlement. Instead, Deb Devon warned Thomas, who warned the other colonists of an imminent threat. Jamestown Governor Sir Francis Wyatt ignored this, and sadly, on March 22, 1622, Opecacano led the slaughter of over 300 people in Jamestown, initiating a war that lasted a decade. Thomas's interpreting services were in even higher demand for military purposes. Soon, various English leaders were vying to have Thomas work exclusively for them. When Thomas declined a request made by Virginia Governor George Yeardley's aide, Captain William Epps, he was convicted of a trumped-up charge of slander. His sentence was to work exclusively for Yeardley and Epps for a minimum of 5 years. Thomas was made the official translator for the Accomack region, but was forbidden to even speak with the native peoples there, except when following the governor's instructions. All the work Thomas did for them, and even prior to this, was done out of his obligation of servitude. He was never paid. By 1627, Governor Yeardley had died, and Captain Epps departed permanently for the West Indies, releasing Thomas from his bonds. Now, at the age of 33, he and his wife were free to make a life together on colonial Virginia's eastern shore. 4 years earlier, Thomas had married an English girl named Hannah. She must have been a remarkable young woman. She had come to the colony by herself, having paid for her own passage. In those days, it was highly unusual for any female to have the resources and autonomy to undertake such an adventure. It's no wonder that two such unique people would find each other. They had one son named John. Sadly, Thomas did not live to see the age of 40. The accounts that I have found do not say what happened to him, just that he was dead by September 1633. It was not unusual at that time for people to live shorter lives, since there was a scarcity of reliable medicine available. He may have simply gotten sick or had an accident. Just the same, he had accomplished a great deal for someone so young. He had served his community with his invaluable translating skills. And Thomas Savage turned a life of hardship into a prosperous adventure. He is believed to have been the first permanent English settler on Virginia's eastern shore, and therefore one of Delmarva's first American dreamers. If you'd like to learn more about this topic, visit our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On January 2, 1784, the entire Chesapeake Bay froze almost all the way to the mouth, blocking shipping lanes until March of that year. And December 26, 1812, our local waterways were frozen by an act of war. The British declared a state of blockade on the Delaware River and the Chesapeake Bay, which lasted until 2 years later on Christmas Day in 1814, when the Treaty at Ghent was signed, ending the war. It's time for our first break. Stick around. When we come back, we'll have our nature segment with a story by Jim Rapp about pelagic birds in our region. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and I'm so glad to spend some time with you today. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about pelagic birding this winter.
Birding on Delmarva is excellent year-round, and winter is no exception. You may think that most of our birds fly south for the winter, but Delmarva is the south for some species that breed further north. If you bundle up, pack your binoculars and explore our birding hotspots, you'll be rewarded with views of birds that you won't find at any other time of the year. Many of our Arctic breeding birds escape the frozen north to feed here during Delmarva's generally balmy winters. Even on our coldest days, Delmarva's coastal waters remain mostly free of ice and full of fish and marine invertebrates. That doesn't mean that survival is easy. Winter still brings challenges, but birds have adaptations to help them stay warm, fat, and happy. Waterfowl and seabirds that winter along our coast wear downy feather coats under a waterproof shell. These birds have oil-producing glands that allow them to apply a waterproof coating when they straighten and clean their feathers with their beaks, a behavior known as preening. Bird feet are mostly bone and sinew covered with scales, with very little tissue that can be damaged by the cold. Some birds have a special adaptation in the circulatory system of their feet and legs that efficiently moves blood between cold outer areas and warm inner areas. Another strategy for staying alive in the winter is to engage in behaviors that do not require intense amounts of energy, such as defending territories, building nests, producing eggs, and feeding hungry chicks. Winter birds tend to be more social and less concerned about their neighbors, which can be beneficial for those of us who like to watch them. Some of Delmarva's best winter birding adventures occur right at the edge of the continent, where land meets sea. Cruising along the Atlantic coast from Cape Charles to Cape Henlopen, you'll find many winter birds that favor the open Atlantic Ocean and barrier islands. The islands are broken up by inlets, where the salty sea flushes the brackish bays during twice daily tides. These dynamic transition zones are the best places to set up shop for seabirds that feed on the bountiful stocks of small fish and marine invertebrates that thrive in our winter waters. Some of these birds are rarely ever seen, even a few hundred yards inland. On weekend winter mornings, you will likely find hardy birders in protective parkas, hats, and gloves peering through spotting scopes along the rock jetties at the Ocean City Inlet in Maryland and the Indian River Inlet in Delaware. Some of the maritime birds can only be seen with high-powered scopes bobbing in the waves or flying just above the horizon. Some of the inlet highlight birds you'll spot in a scope are known as alcids or auks. These open ocean birds have stocky, streamlined bodies, short, narrow wings and stubby tails, and most have a crisp black and white color pattern. Due to their similar body shape and colors, alcids are sometimes referred to as penguins of the north. Penguins, however, are only found in the southern hemisphere and can't fly. Two alcids you may find at Delmarva's inlets are the large razorbill and the diminutive dovekie. The length of a razorbill is just under 17 inches, and the dovekie is about half that size. Both birds breed on sea cliffs in the North Atlantic and migrate south to the Delmarva coast in the winter. This is Jim Rapp, and you're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. We're talking about birding at Delmarva's Atlantic coast inlets in the winter. Razorbills and dovekies dive into the ocean, using their wings, feet, and streamlined bodies to chase their underwater prey. Both species eat fish and small crustaceans, but the razorbill eats more fish than the dovekie, which favors invertebrates. Razorbills dive up to 400 feet, while the dovekie spends most of its time feeding just below the surface. While you may catch razorbills and dovekies flying with rapid, flapping wing beats just above the water, scan the skies above the horizon for other winter birds. Flocks of sharp-looking white northern gannets can be seen engaging in spectacular plunge dives for fish. Hundreds of birds can sometimes be seen diving into the Atlantic from heights of up to 130 feet, creating long plumes as they hit the water like torpedoes and descend into the deep. Once underwater, gannets can swim up to 72 feet to catch fish. Flocks of stocky scoters can be seen flying along the horizon with gannets, but large rafts of these mostly black, chunky sea ducks can also be found bobbing in the water closer to shore. You can find three species of scoter along Delmarva's coast in the winter: the fairly common black and surf scoter, and the less common white-winged scoter. They dive underwater to yank mollusks and marine invertebrates from the jetty rocks and ocean floor with their strong, thick bills. Another stocky duck, the common eider, can also be found at the inlets. They have a distinctive wedge-shaped head with a long bill. During the breeding season in the north, Eiders are quite colorful, but they normally appear drab brown to blackish during their Delmarva winters. The elegant long-tailed duck can often be seen surfing the inlet waves, sometimes with human surfers in their thick black wetsuits. Formerly known as the Old Squaw, this medium-sized duck is now named for the male's long, pointed tail feathers. The long-tailed duck is one of the deepest diving ducks in the world, reaching depths of 200 feet when hunting for marine invertebrates. The brant is a small sea goose that resembles the common Canada goose, with its gray-brown body and black head and neck with a white, partly broken collar. It dabbles in the shallow water, feeding mostly on marine grasses, seaweed, and sea lettuce with its short, stubby bill. Brant can occasionally be found grazing on grassy lawns near the coast. For many, the favorite inlet bird is the incredibly gorgeous harlequin duck. Although rarely seen on Delmarva in flocks of more than two or three birds, the sight of this colorful diving duck is worth braving the winter elements. The colors of the male harlequin range from slate blue to chestnut brown, broken by crisp white streaks, spots, and stripes. This is one bird you should Google to get the full effect of its kaleidoscopic physical appearance. Harlequin ducks prefer the fast-moving tides and rocky shores of the inlets, which is reminiscent of the New England coast. If you want to experience Delmarva's inlet birding before these amazing animals head north in early spring, join the expert guides leading field trips during the Delmarva Winter Birding Weekend. For more information, please visit www.delmarvabirding.com.
Thanks, Jim. This year, the Winter Birding Weekend is January 27th through the 29th. Find links and details for this and other outdoor events on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/nature. It's time for another break now, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll have an end-of-the-year arts review. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and I hope you're having a great New Year's Eve day so far. It's the end of the year, and like many people, I'm taking stock, looking back on this year and actually a few behind it. I began producing the Delmarva Almanac online 8 years ago as a way to attract clients who wanted multimedia websites and especially to improve my writing skills. Since then, I've interviewed 112 artists who live and work here on Delmarva. A few were musicians, some directed theater productions, and a few ran art galleries. There were a small number of writers and photographers. There were 17 artists who made three-dimensional work in wood, glass, metal, stone, clay, and fiber. 12 were artisans who made functional fine art crafts like jewelry and pottery. And there were 66 visual artists working in a variety of two-dimensional mediums and styles. The most popular genre altogether was Impressionist painting, with 30 practitioners. My interview subjects ranged in age from their early 20s to their mid-80s. Most of them had been making art since they were children. At the same time, it was common to hear that someone had an unrelated career for most of their life and became a full-time artist in their retirement. The interviewees were chosen for the quality of their work, and often because someone in their community recommended them when they were about to have a show or present a special project to the public. Just one person described themselves as more of a hobbyist than a professional artist. I really only met two people who could be described as stereotypical diva artistes with big egos and arrogant attitudes. It was pretty amazing to find that across the board, just about all of them were humble people who lived simply and viewed their art as a calling, not as a way to make a living. Many had day jobs, though by my calculation, 72% actually were supporting themselves primarily with their artwork. That's pretty good, and more than you might expect. So that describes these artists by the numbers. They were, and are, much more than that. I've learned a great deal from these folks. In fact, these last 8 years have almost been like a very long but enjoyable master's course at what I like to call the Delmarva School of Art. Now, many of these folks would be great teachers in terms of technique. However, I steered away from that in our conversations, because many of them offer courses or workshops, and I didn't want them to give away something for free that they usually charge for. My primary objective was to talk with them about why they loved making art and what inspired them, in order to introduce them to the public and promote their work. There were some artists who never returned my calls or emails trying to get an interview with them. Not everyone wants to be recorded talking about themselves. Those who did were incredibly generous with their time. We would sometimes talk for more than an hour to get a story that lasted less than 10 minutes. Often it was just fun to swap stories about being an artist, which hopefully made some usually shy folks a little bit more comfortable. I felt that my job was to ask a few questions and then get out of the way. I had never met the majority of my subjects before we talked. There were about a dozen that I did know. For example, Dana Simpson and I have known each other for several decades. She is recognized for her whimsical painting and clay creations.
I just always loved sitting there and going into my mind and emptying my mind out on paper, and it was just very joyful. And I think that it's very important, you know, probably in my development, because that was just like practicing like the scales, as if I was going to play an instrument. And so I just continued to stretch my imagination and hone my craft and skills, and all these years later, it's still that much fun.
Dana is one of those people who, whenever we run into each other, I am struck by how simpatico we are and how many overlaps there are in our creative interests. Another is Patrick Henry. He and his family have known my family for a very long time. He's the only person that I interviewed twice for the Almanac. In part, that was because he is so well known for his easily recognized, cheerful, impressionist paintings. Also, he's just a joy to talk to.
I have always walked with this strong inner voice, and I'm very curious. I study everything. Travel, they had said, you know, really opens the minds of artists. And sure enough, it was no way I could come back here and look at those images and see a few that I want to try. I want to go... to a realm other than somebody want me to paint this or that, and to, you know, just explore.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and this is our end of the year art review. Some artists really inspired me. Denise Dumont is another impressionist painter with a distinctive style. Her subtle hues and pastoral landscapes invoke such a feeling of peace.
Brush marks are almost like fingerprints. They really are unique, and every artist has them, whether they are conscious or not. I'm a painter at heart because I actually take pleasure in the physicality of it. And so I like the way the brush feels in the paint and the way it goes on the canvas. It's part of the love of oil painting, I think.
Lillian Ripa is a Chinese brush painter in her 80s who is extremely prolific. Her reverence for the ancient traditions, handmade materials, and a daily work ethic result in paintings with amazing spontaneity and vitality.
You have to know your subject. You have to know your strokes that you want to use before you start your painting. Then you have the freedom to do whatever you want. So if I put a stroke down on the paper, and I'm not strong, or I'm weak, or I'm not interested, it shows, and it looks shaky. I don't paint with anything in front of me. I have to see that. And I can take a picture, but you have to get the essence from that. Otherwise, you'll have a photograph. I have to carry that in my memory. And then I analyze it. Do I need certain strokes? What do I want to show on this? All my ink is ground, all my colors are ready. Everything has to be ready. You have maybe worked on some strokes for quite a while, but when I go to do the painting itself, that has to be all behind me, and I have to be able to do that with my soul.
I love that she said that she found a sense of freedom in her daily discipline. Indeed, artists are a diligent lot. Even when it looks like we're sitting around daydreaming, our minds are busy at work. I also found that an optimistic outlook is very common among the creative community here. Maybe it's a reflection on my choices for interview subjects, but I can't really think of any whose work was predominantly about the dark side of life, pain, or suffering. Delmarva is known as the land of pleasant living, after all. Artists move here for the light and the laid-back lifestyle, so that clearly affects their perspective. Another trait that is universally held by many longtime artists is their tenacity. When I asked them to offer advice to people new to making art, just about all of them talked about never giving up. Some warned about the financial and social pressures against starting a career in the arts. But they all said that once you know what it is that you want to do, you should not let any obstacle get in your way. That's good counsel no matter what you do for a living. Not one of these artists could imagine a life without making art. It seems that once infected by art, it is almost impossible to shake it from your soul. Which brings me to where I am now, personally. Over the years, I have continued to paint, wedding gifts, and the occasional commission. Now it seems my own art infection has come back full force. It's time for the Delmarva Almanac and much of my freelance business to go on hiatus while I dive back into the creative waters of painting. So this will be our last radio show. Our online publication will take a break and come back in some form or fashion next summer. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter for regular Delmarva trivia and for a heads up about our plans, which include a book called The Delmarva School of Art. In the meantime, I'd like to thank all the people who made this show possible. Jim Rapp and Dave Wilson for their wonderful nature stories. Our talented occasional contributors, Scott Duncan, Marilyn Burkle, Gretchen Hansen, and Kiana Bowen. Thank you to all the people who agreed to tell us your story. I wish I had time to mention each and every one of you who shared their sage wisdom and creative insight with us. Every one of you is an inspiration. Thank you also to our underwriters, EatDrinkByArt.com, all the towns and arts-loving organizations that participated in our program, and volunteers who encouraged us, including Marina Dowdle, Ann Jenkins, and Lee Nelson, and especially Lisa Challenger, who was instrumental in getting this show off the ground and on the air. I'd like to thank the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio and the Community Foundation of the Eastern Shore for all their support. And I'd like to give a big grateful shout-out to Dana Whitehair and Chris Rank right here at the radio station for all they did for us. Finally, I'd like to thank you, our audience, for spending your time with us every week. If you enjoy this type of local cultural programming, I hope you will become a member of Delmarva Public Radio as a holiday gift to yourself. I also hope you'll check out the art strolls held monthly in a town near you. So that's all for the Delmarva Almanac. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Happy New Year, and until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.